Welcome to Talking History. We're talking today to Richard Wortman of Columbia University. Professor Wortman has followed a trajectory in his research which is not typical of most historians, in that he started out with institutions and then moved to individuals. He started out with working on the development of a legal consciousness in Russia with Russian populism. In his last two books, though, Richard Wortman has been working on the Russian czars, the myths that they created for themselves, and the way in which they used images to convey their ideology to the population. In the time of Nicholas II, who ruled from the end of the 1890s until 1917, this was an especially difficult maneuver to pull off. Because, of course, Nicholas II was faced with a workers' movement, a strike movement, and a revolutionary movement. Nicholas II tried to cope with these in a variety of different ways, but certainly did not stop at the use of force, perhaps most notably on Bloody Sunday on January the 9th, 1905. His police and his soldiers did fire on a group of demonstrators who were unarmed workers, and it was this image that would be used against him by the revolutionaries for some time to come. So on the one hand, we have the image of Bloody Sunday and the putting down of strikes in very harsh ways. On the other hand, we have a ruler who's a devoted family man with five beautiful children. And Professor Richard Wortman is going to talk to us about how we can reconcile these two very different images of the same man. And I'd like to ask you, why do we need to revisit Nicholas II?
We need to revisit Nicholas II because Nicholas II has become the object of various idealizations of people recently, and the tendency to try to apologize for some of his acts and to romanticize his reign and to see perhaps the personal side of his life rather than the historical side of his life and the political acts that that made his reign important and crucial in as far as I can see in Russian history. So I would say that people have enjoyed thinking of his reign, have enjoyed going to exhibitions about him, reading popular biographies, going to movies about him, but this has very little to do with the historical reality. By the same token, in Russia, Nicholas II has become a kind of cult figure to certain people, a saint. He's been canonized, but this has very little to do with what he was like as a ruler, his actions, so that we're dealing with figments of our imagination, and it's worth revisiting the historical Nicholas rather than the mythologized Nicholas that we entertain ourselves with.
But this is pretty interesting, because your last few books have talked about the mythical nature of the Russian monarchy and how much attention they devoted to their public relations, to creating a sort of myth, a sort of image of themselves. So it seems a little surprising, to say the least, that someone who spends his time working on the myth of the czars, or the created myth of the czars, is now saying that we shouldn't look at it.
No, I'm not saying that. I am saying that we should look at the we should study myths so that we are not limited by them. And the myths that are now generated are not the myths that govern the czars. My books are on the myths that govern the czars, which one should study, because these and the myth that Nicholas himself generated, because this is the way he understood reality. But we should not get it into our heads that he understands reality the way we do, and that he looked upon reality with our eyes, with the kind of eyes of either middle-class America or the spirituality of current Russia, because his viewpoint as a monarch, as a European monarch, as a monarch in the Russian mythological tradition, gave him a mentality which is totally alien to ours and which we can study and understand.
Well, then let's go back a little bit. What is the myth that Nicholas created of himself, and how is it different from the myth that's being created about him now?
The myth that he created about himself was one that he didn't completely create by himself. It was created for him, partly, and partly he created it for himself. It was a myth of a national czar, bound closely with the people, who was a very much akin to the people, who had a spiritual and symbolic mandate to rule the country because of this particular kinship, and one who, because of this, was freed from many of the attitudes, obligations, and constraints that govern the Russian state. In other words, this kind of popular sentiment made him much more hostile to the officialdom, to state institutions, particularly those with legal characteristics, than his predecessors. And as a result, many of his acts were anti-state in goal and in effect, anti-state in the sense of being subversive of traditions of legality and institutionalizations that had been developed under previous regimes. By the same token, he placed great faith in the armed forces. He placed great faith in the, to a certain degree, out of necessity, in the security organs, which pointed towards the development of a kind of personal monarchy based on the people, and which was rooted in certain intellectuals' views. A group called the Slavophiles from the 19th century, which had been developed over the 19th century, the notion that in the 17th century there existed a true Russian monarchy with connections to the people, not corrupted by westernization and not corrupted by institutionalization, with direct feelings for the people. And Nicholas thought that he was restoring this, and he gave all sorts of indications and symbolic displays in the church architecture, in his various statements, in the great costume ball of 1903, that he believed Russia would achieve the grandeur that he thought was in this 17th century. Now, this is a mythical 17th century. It's not a historical 17th century. It's a 17th century of harmony and the unity between Tsar and people. And this has little to do with the history of the 17th century, but the kind of mythical history he governed himself by inspired him in this way, and inspired him to take certain acts that had really nothing to do with the political and social developments of that time.
But what you're saying is that Nicholas II sort of came to this on his own, on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, you're saying that he inherited this conception from the czars that came
right
before him.
Both are true. The notion of the 17th century as a kind of founding period of Russian monarchy was introduced earlier in his father's reign, after 1881, after the assassination of Alexander II, and he grew up with this. But with his father, did not have the sense of identification with the common people that Nicholas had, nor did he have the aversion to the officials that Nicholas displayed. He did dislike certain parts of the bureaucracy, but he was able to work with them. And Alexander III's vision is was to change the bureaucracy into a true Russian bureaucracy. And this was really the inspiration of the counter-reforms. Nicholas II never expected to do this. He just didn't like officials, personally, politically, and he expressed his feelings fairly openly, which didn't make them feel particularly good about him.
Isn't this a little surprising for somebody who, after all, is groomed to be a monarch?
Well, that's part of the problem. The grooming to be a monarch was not done with Nicholas II the way it had been, because Alexander III did not take his education as seriously as previous czars did. So the upbringing is a key factor here. Basically, the national myth is set forth in Alexander III's reign tended to downplay the importance of education. And to emphasize the importance of ideology, divine inspiration, national inspiration. While under previous regimes, previous heirs to the throne, the Tsarevichs, heard that they were going to be the rulers of a great country, they had to improve themselves to get up to that level. Nicholas II never had this, which might account for the kind of smug and extremely confident manner he bore himself with, which is quite different from his predecessors.
But that's very interesting, because the sort of image of Nicholas II that one often hears in Western historical scholarship is that he was very insecure and relied on his empress, relied on Rasputin, relied on the advice of other people.
Well, I think that's basically untrue. He was insecure at the beginning of his reign. He was 26 when he took the throne, and he did not feel that he was capable of ruling. Not that 26 was that young for a monarch, but he was a very immature 26. And his father, who died in his early 50s, completely unexpectedly, just had left him totally unprepared. And compared to, say, Alexander II or even Alexander III. Alexander III had sat in cabinet meetings, committee of ministers meetings with his father, and so had Alexander II with his father, Nicholas I. So that's true. At the beginning, he was extremely insecure, and he relied on his mother and the Grand Dukes. However, this insecurity, this personal insecurity, made him extremely defensive, too. He in a way strengthened the basic convictions that he held to, that were guides in how he should act. So in a way, the fact that he was insecure does not contradict the fact that he had these absolutely certain beliefs, because they were the anchor that he rested on. He was afraid to stray away from them, and he became even more attached to these particular symbols and images of the past.
Now, you had said that Nicholas mistrusted legal institutions, mm-hmm. and one of your first books was on, of course, the development of a Russian legal consciousness. Maybe if you said a few words about when Russia got a legal consciousness, this might help us to understand why it was Nicholas more than any other right. czar who mistrusted legal institutions and legal ideas.
Well, the legal consciousness developed slowly in Russia, because Russia lacked a kind of tradition of independent judicial institutions or a reputable judiciary or bar. And it develops largely through the state and through the offices and the efforts of the monarchy. They had a lot of trouble, because it's hard to create a judiciary through a centralized authoritarian state. However, this was done through the early 19th century, but it was a dependent judicial institutions that were basically under administrative control. But all the monarchs wanted reforms, because the judicial system was a source of scandal. It was slow, it was corrupt, it was inefficient. Everyone knew this. Every emperor who came to the throne in the 18th and 19th century talked about reforming the judiciary, though only a limited amount was done. Now, Nicholas I in the 1830s finally got a law code introduced, or a law digest of laws. And then, during the great reforms, after the emancipation of the serfs, you have the creation of an independent judiciary in the judicial reform of 1864. So by the time Nicholas came to the throne, this was the one of the few independent islands in the autocracy. The other was the local institutions of self-government, which were called Ziemstva. But this also meant that more and more legalistically minded officials were in the bureaucracy at the high levels, many of them who were involved in the formulation and implementation of the judicial reforms. And with the revolutionary movement, the autocracy felt itself constrained because many of the courts took the size of the revolutionaries. So with Alexander III's reign, Alexander III reversed the tendency of liberal reform and started this kind of anti-legal feeling in the bureaucracy, and wanted to basically undo the judicial reform, but he only lived 13 years as Tsar, and so Nicholas came to the throne inheriting this anti-legal disposition, seeing the legal system as being basically antagonistic to the principle of monarchy. And all this fit into this Petrine myth, because basically Peter the Great who introduced the Western concept of law to Russia, and going back beyond and finding the true Russian state in a personal monarchy that wasn't encumbered by legal institutions was something that very much influenced Nicholas.
You said that the courts tended to sympathize with the revolutionaries. Isn't that a little bit surprising if they're the sort of agents of the autocracy?
Well, they were agents of the autocracy, but they were brought up in this period when you have improved legal education, acquaintanceship with the West, and a respect for the law. So they felt themselves that they had to follow principles of process and justice and legal principles. And I wouldn't say that they all sided with the revolutionaries, but in terms of their legal rights, many of them did, particularly in the early 70s. So some of the revolutionaries were condemned, but a great number of them were acquitted. And the new bar, the new lawyers that appeared after 1864, there were not lawyers to speak of before then. There was no independent legal profession. Often took the sides of the revolutionaries and tried to stigmatize the state and show their oppressiveness and their persecution. Since the court reform of 1864 was based on the principle of open justice and public justice, this came into conflict with the basic notion of the autocracy, that the autocracy should do what it wanted with the opposition.
But clearly Nicholas realized that he couldn't just get rid of the legal system overnight. So how then could he, or how did he, go about trying to convey this image of the Tsar who is, if not above the law, has a sort of a unique mystical relation with the people that no one who doesn't share it can possibly understand?
Yes, well, a lot of these problems were, by the time he came to the throne, were already dispensed with, because a lot of the political trials of these involved were removed from the courts and put into the administrative order, so that by this time the independence of the system in terms of political trials had been considerably abridged. In Alexander III's reign, many of the senators, the Senate in Russia was the highest judicial institutions, had been appointed who were not sympathetic to independent justice. So you had a kind of mix in there, but many of them were. So the way that he dealt with this is basically by high-handedly ignoring institutions. I mean, he did not try openly to dismantle them. And as far as ordinary criminal and civil law went, this did not concern him anyway. But he did not want to follow regular procedures. And, for example, in terms of the introduction of the gold standard, which was opposed by the state council, which was the supreme legislative council. They had no controlling veto on what the Tsar did, but they did vote. Nicholas didn't even want that, because it's quite clear that the nobles in the state council did not want the gold standard. So what he did simply was to issue it as a decree. And there are more and more things like this when he was given the opportunity that he tried to do. But basically he didn't do very much. He couldn't do very much because the government was on his own. But what he looked forward to is a kind of resumption of the old relationships. The problem is that he had not been Tsar very long when the troubles developed. So whatever his goal was, he could not really realize it. But what he tried to do is to undermine the figures who supported these types of legal institutions, who supported trying openness in society, who supported the independent institutions, and put over them officials who were directly responsible to his own will, many of them not having much to do with each other. So what he was striving for is really a personal autocracy where he decided everything through very close officials whom he could trust, most of whom did not come out of the bureaucracy, became perhaps out of the police apparatus, or were conservative noblemen like Scipiagin, police apparatus Pleva, and not through the other parts of the administration which had been affected. So he's trying to break free from this when things started going crazy, and the social movement started to develop, strikes started to develop, the liberal movement started to develop. So he found himself only 6 years after ascending the throne with a growing, even a few years, the strike movement develops only 2 years after he comes to the throne, with a social movement that he really doesn't know how to handle and that the autocracy had not dealt with before.
So how does he cope?
He copes in the way of the national myth in general, and that is by utilizing force and the notion that if a monarchy, a national monarchy, is going to win the sympathy of its citizens, it has to exert powerful, ruthless, punitive force. And this comes out of a kind of new nationalism set forth by Michael Katkoff in his newspaper Moskovskoye Vyedomosti, and his journal that he published. And this is different from the traditional conservatives. The traditional conservatives didn't want industrialization because they were afraid that industrialization would make Russia more like the West, and they were proud that Russia was. The new nationalists thought that the Russian state was so powerful it could cope with any force, that the Russian people believed in the state, there was unity with the state, therefore industrialization could take place. And if you had strikes, the instruments of punitive force would be able to cope with them very easily because the Russian state was mighty. So you could do whatever you want, pretty much. This is what motivated Witter, who was a disciple of Katkoff, in the heavy industrialization.
Wasn't there also a sense that the imperial government could co-opt the strike movement or the labor movement?
That came at the same time. Well, there were two senses, because the government was divided. The Ministry of Interior started to co-opt it, which is another aspect of the national myth. This was began in Moscow, where the Tsar's uncle, the Grand Duke Sergei, was the Governor General under one of the officials of the police called by the name of Sergei Zubatov, where you have police unions trying to make the to win over the workers from the revolutionaries. And this was based on the same national premise, that the people were loyal to the autocracy, that could be loyal if they were given the chance, and that the workers, and the workers were considered displaced peasants at this time legally, could be that their loyalty could be mobilized, and so they taught them that they could get some kind of resolution for their demands through the through what were called police unions, and there were demonstrations, and they sang religious songs, and they went to church services and had religious lectures. So all of this was another part. But this was basically Moscow-based. Some of the officials in St. Petersburg, among them Witte, were terrified of this because they were afraid that it would get out of hand. And they were proved right. I mean, basically, the union, several of the Zubatov unions got out of control of the police and started striking on their own. And eventually, even before the revolution of 1905, most of them were, they tried to discontinue them.
Okay, so if the police union movement sort of either fizzled out or ended up working out in a way that the government didn't want it to develop in, that there are the punitive measures, like, for example, the harsh putting down of the Leonard Goldfield strike, mm-hmm. for example, just to pick one obvious example. It was this very harsh putting down of strikes that was used by Soviet historiography to portray Nicholas as an extremely, well, I'm not going to say sadistic, but an extremely harsh mm-hmm. ruler. So it's surprising that the new national myth of him, or that the new myth of Nicholas II, is one of someone who's extremely mild.
Yes, yes.
How do you reconcile?
Well,
this?
I mean, I reconcile it in two ways. One, the Soviets were distorted their history so much that everyone believed that if they said something was black, it must be white, and something was white, it must be black. So there is that impulse. Also, personally, he was mild. And also, he let other people take the. He gave orders very clearly to repress these strikes, but he let other people bear the brunt of the responsibility. Often, he told the Minister of Interior or the generals involved. Now, the Vienna Goldfield strike was sort of a mishap. It's not clear how that started, since it was way out in Siberia. But in Bloody Sunday, it's quite clear that though Nicholas didn't give the orders, that the troops were in, that the generals had the possibility to fire on demonstrations. This was not ruled out, and Nicholas never said it was ruled out. And in February 1917, or January 1917, when everything was breaking loose and there was chaos in Petrograd, the orders that Nicholas gave all the time was, be ready to use force, use fire when necessary on the insurgents. That was the only order. And so basically such a retributive policy has its limits, because once the whole population is, you can't shoot down the whole population. So, I mean, this Katkovian mentality was something that was in the end self-defeating, and particularly since it was this that encouraged some of the rapid industrialization that made the mass strike movement